Have you ever wondered just what is required to achieve a well-balanced and healthy life? What really is wellness, and how does one achieve the highest state of well-being? The belief is we can unite globally and join together in a conversation that will open the doorway to living at the highest possible state of peacefulness and well-being for all. From the Pacific Northwest, it's the Wellness Roadshow with your host, Catherine Bradford.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is Catherine Bradford, and I'm very glad to be with you today, Wednesday, August the 13th. Hard to believe already. Anyway, welcome aboard, and thank you for joining me this hour. Nathaniel J. Williams, at the age of 5, found himself, along with 9 of his 11 siblings, placed under the authority of the New York City foster care system as a result of the death of their mother from a cranial aneurysm. These years no doubt left a deep impression on what would become his personal and professional life as he grew up. Adversity often creates greatness, and I can honestly say that I have seen no better example than that of the life story of Nathaniel Williams. Devoting his adult life to helping people reach their fullest potential, Dr. Williams spends a great deal of time and energy providing training and workshops in areas such as stress management, time management, ethics, conflict avoidance and resolution, and customer service and loyalty. Dr. Williams earned 2 of his 3 graduate degrees from the nation's 2 oldest historically African-American universities, a master's in human services from Lincoln University of Pennsylvania, and a master's in public administration from Kenyi University in Pennsylvania. In addition, he earned his doctorate in education at Fielding Graduate University. He is currently pursuing his 4th graduate degree, a Master's of Business Administration at Strayer University. Dr. Williams has been the president and CEO of Human Works Affiliates Incorporated, a cluster of 8 corporations focused on human services since 1993. These corporations provide group homes, foster care, and life sharing, supports for individuals living independently, among many other vital social services. He serves on numerous boards, is a member of many committees devoted to many important social issues. His dedication is unparalleled. His desire to raise the quality of life, the opportunity for success for all individuals, is truly a blessing to all of us. Recently, he published the book, The Navigator of Life, Keeping Your Ship of Life in Balance and on Course. In his book, you'll find strategies to help you fulfill personal and professional goals, with an emphasis on satisfaction through fulfillment and emotional happiness. His purpose is simply to offer people the tools for making balanced decisions. He dedicates his book to you in the hope that you will overcome any challenges and make decisions that propel you to reach your fullest potential. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Williams. Welcome, Dr. Williams. Hello.
Hear me?
Oh, yes, I can hear you. Thank you, Dr. Williams.
Thank you.
I'm sorry there. How are you today?
Very good, thank you.
And you are actually enjoying a holiday yourself, are you not?
Yes, I am. Cape Cod. So.
Very good. With the whole family, I hope.
Yes, sir.
Taking a break from that quite busy schedule of yours, I'll tell you, as I kept reading and reading about all the things you're involved with, I was thinking, oh, my goodness, where's the balance? We must have balance, huh?
Well, we've been very fortunate this summer. We got away for a week in June and July and now in August. So
right.
Don't cry for me, Argentina, as they say.
Right. No kidding. Well, I also meant to say that you are the father of 6 children,
right.
5 boys and 1 girl. Poor little girl there. that keeps you busy too, no?
For sure. She holds her own, let me tell you.
Oh, I meant, where is she in the lineup?
She is child number. She's one of, we had a set of twins.
So, oh, yeah. Good.
We had 1 boy and 1 girl, so I think she's number 4.
Good, yes.
And we're also expecting at the end of February of 2009. So,
Oh, my goodness. That is a big family. Very good. Sure. Well, congratulations to you.
Thank you so much.
You know, I was so moved, first of all, not only by the story of, you know, as I said at the beginning here, where you've come from, quite obvious, you have seen through your circumstances a path that is really emerging out and manifesting this amazing life purpose and living the life purpose it more than most people I know. And I want to spend a little time at the beginning of this hour together really sharing with our listeners just a bit of what goes on or what came in your past from this experience of being in this foster system for so long with so many of your siblings.
Sure. The system itself, the foster care system, is supposed to serve as a safety net for children and also for families inadvertently. In my situation, my mother died of an aneurysm when I was 5.
Right.
And of the 12 children she had, there were at least 6 different fathers. Trying to place the children upon her death with the fathers was somewhat of a challenge, and in my situation, even more of a challenge because there is no father listed on my birth certificate.
Mm-hmm.
Two out of the 12 were able to be placed with their father. Actually, they were already living with their father at the time of my mother's death, and the other 10 children then went into foster care directly after the funeral. They had arranged for taxi cabs to be there at the funeral home when the funeral was over.
Yeah.
And then they divided us up, and we went off to 5 different
facilities.
Mm-hmm.
Were you at age 5, did you have the capacity to have some comprehension of what was going on other than the trauma of the obvious?
No. What's very interesting for children is that generally they do remember the trauma of those kinds of circumstances. So I remember, you know, very clearly that something was going on. But I remember the evening before the actual funeral, we were in the funeral parlor, and my uncle came to call on my mother and was a little bit angry with her, also was somewhat intoxicated, and smacked her while she was laying in the casket. So,
oh,
that
my
is,
goodness.
You know, it's those kind of memories when kids have those kind of events very early in their life that they're able to remember.
Right.
So that was a rather trying circumstance. We were able to go off to a pretty nice foster home, and we stayed there for about 6 years.
Oh, wow. How many of you were in the same home?
Basically, they paired us off in 2.
Okay.
So I was in a foster home with my brother Gregory.
Okay.
And then my other 2 brothers were together, and then same thing for my 2 sisters.
Right.
The older boys went off to a group home in Queens, New York. So I think the 4 of them then went off to a group home.
Mm-hmm.
So those 4 were together, and then the other were split into pairs of 2.
Right. And was that pretty standard operating for the system back then?
Sure. And also, it is very rare that you get a cluster of 10 kids.
Yes.
Coming into foster care on from one family.
Right.
So that was really a challenge. Over the years, I have seen efforts to try to keep them together, and even, we've gotten calls as a provider, as an adult. I've been a provider of foster care services, and we've tried to put them together, open up programs so that families could stay together, even if it was just for a short period of time. So I think the system now would be a little bit more responsive to trying to keep the family together,
right,
if they were all to go into foster care at one time.
Couldn't I ask basically what time frame this was when you were placed?
Sure. I was born in 65. My mom passed away in 1970. So I stayed in foster care from 1970 to 1983.
Wow, yeah, okay. Well, you know, not to say anything negative about your family before your mom passed away, but certainly with that kind of number of children and that many fathers, I don't know how much of a safe haven you had or felt that you had in the 5 years of your life with your mom ahead of time.
You know, what was interesting in talking with my family at different occasions over the years,
mm-hmm,
is that we were not a family that had a great amount of resources, but they really talked about how she was wonderful in the morning of being able to put pots on the stove, and somehow or another, every single night, by the end of the night, there was food in those pots. So it was just amazing how she was able to be resourceful.
Yes.
To making those things happen. But you're correct. It was definitely very trying. I do have faint memories of having to share a bed with several of my brothers. So definitely the resources were somewhat skimpy, to say the least.
Yes. Well, you know, I guess in comparison, I'm just trying to set the stage here for us to understand a little bit, because I think that it shows that much more the remarkable accomplishment that you have achieved over these years of taking the path that you did take yourself, and, of course, creating this book has such modeling that must come from so many of these challenges that you faced and turning them in, like I said, you know, making a silk purse out of a sow's ear, right?
Sure.
And,
for sure.
When you think about it, of course, you had these challenges. You had all these siblings from 0 to 5 years old, you know, with all these imprints that hit you, as I said, you know, and you sure share in the book, you know, take a look at where you come from, how important that is. But, you know, at five, then you go into this foster situation. Would you say, and did you stay in the same family for all those years from 70 to 80?
No, for 6 years we stayed there.
Okay.
With the same family, and they were a very nice family. It was two girls that were in the family, as well as the foster father and a foster mother. And then there were two children, one boy and one girl, who were living outside of the home as well.
Okay.
The foster father worked for the Transit Authority, which in New York City is a pretty good job to have.
Right.
He got up pretty early in the morning and came back in the early afternoon. And the foster mom was a stay-at-home foster mom.
Yes.
So it was a pretty nice situation. It came to a very sad, you know, end that when I was about 11, I had my brother Gregory lived in the same home with us, and
right.
He went to the agency office for an annual physical, and my physical was fine, but they had found marks on the body of Gregory, and so had to then remove him from the foster home. But what was very interesting for me in retrospect is they asked me the question, which I think is a life-changing kind of question to ask a child. They said, being that there are no allegations of abuse against you, do you want to return back to the foster home?
Hmm.
And now, I love the foster parents very much, but I had said, you know, no thank you. I'd like to stay with my brother.
Yes.
And so they then moved us to a foster home. What was interesting is that they moved us to a foster home where the foster parents only spoke Spanish.
Oh, my goodness.
And, of course, we did not. So it was a very nice home, and I had no idea that, you know, he was being abused during that time period, but he was, and so that was the end of being in that foster home.
Yeah.
And that was pretty much the only consistent foster home that I had in those 13 years. That was the longest stretch, and then, you know, generally I stayed a year or 2 years in other places up until I was 18.
Right. And Dr. Williams, your brother then was, Gregory was the victim of the abuse of the original family that you were with for the 6 years, and you said you had no memory of anything happening to
you. Again, no physical, I mean, there was definitely nothing I ever saw that was of physical nature.
Right.
That would have left the marks that they eventually found. Mm-hmm. You know, as with any child, there are moments where kids are trying, but nothing mm-hmm. I could ever recall would warrant, not that there ever is any situation, but would warrant
right, right.
that kind of intervention. So,
right, right.
Again, when I heard the circumstance, they asked the question, I was very, very surprised that happened.
Yeah. You know, I think when I look over all this, and I'm having certainly a better picture of, you know, what you just went through, because it's sort of like we find out through the book and through the information about you that you had this experience, but there's these big gaps, and then suddenly you're a very multi-degreed, you know, adult, very high achieving, and you're like, wait, what happened? You know, did he get hooked up with Lassie's family, you know, and get just the best, you know, little Timmy and Dr. Williams were just happy as could be, you know, riding off into the sunset there. I don't know what it was. I mean, you must be asked this a lot. What in you're looking over your shoulder back at the past, could you say, were seeds that came up for you that were planted by these experiences that pushed you so heavily into this higher than normal and average state of achievement with regard to just all things, but certainly academically?
Sure. I do think that genetics play a major part in who we are as individuals.
Yes.
It's just amazing to sit around and listen to my brothers and sisters talk, and for people that have spent so much of their lives apart from each other, and I'm talking decades apart from each other,
yes.
to have so much in common, it's just unbelievable.
Yes.
So I do believe that played a major part. I think that our parentage, and especially our mother, because that's the common bond that we all share.
Of course.
Something that is hard to describe, what she must have given each of the children, because in each of their own rights, they have been real movers and shakers and making things happen in their own worlds. And
right.
some have been worlds that have been legal, and some of those have been worlds that have been illegal. But yeah. definitely, you know, taking a leadership, trying to make things happen, has definitely been something that all of her children were definitely given as a gift.
Isn't that?
Yeah, we may not have been mm-hmm. given very many resources from a material or a financial standpoint, but I definitely believe we were definitely given a lot when it comes to some attributes that would serve us well as we got older.
How old was your mom when she passed?
I think she was just around 39, 40 when she had passed. And she was also told, with that many children, to really to slow down.
Yes.
And that this was the risk that she could have because her health was somewhat challenged.
Right.
And what was interesting is my oldest sister, Barbara, had just had a baby, and then my mother just had a baby. So it was challenging to have that kind of circumstance where the mother and the daughter were having children at the same time.
You know, I think with families that have that many children, and that's sort of inevitable, you know.
The math has to add up.
Yes, and the mom just doesn't stop, and the oldest gets oldest enough where that happens and stuff.
Sure.
Yeah, I sure see it. What about relatives on your mom's side? Did you have, you know, knowledge of where they came from, what their roots were? When you talk about this genetic, you know, gene or the genetics of a family predisposing you to certain capabilities, do you look over your shoulder and look back at any of that?
Yes, there was only one aunt that I had a chance to meet. There was also an Uncle Richard. I didn't really know him very well.
Mm-hmm.
The sad thing is, because of the lack of connections that you have with your family, the times that you do meet them as an adult is generally at funerals.
Yes.
And, of course, that's a terrible time to try to gather information. But
right.
I did have a chance, maybe about three or four occasions, to be with Aunt Grace. She lived in a housing project in the Bronx and was a building captain for security. And so they would have these events in the parking lot where people cooked out and listened to music, and she would sit there with her table, and we'd come visit her. And so she really was a very, very strong, stoic woman.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't want to mess around with her too much. But there were times in which she would bring some pictures down from her apartment or other things to share with us.
Mm-hmm.
But that was very limited. And again, generally being at funerals, we generally hear more of the information. But they were not in any position. They were asked by the city of New York to please consider taking some of the children. And most of them felt that if they couldn't take them all, they wouldn't take any.
Right.
And in talking with my brothers and sisters over the years, there have been some challenges to that. There are some feelings that they should have done something for whoever they could have. But again, we weren't in their circumstances, and
yes.
I'm sure the immediacy of finding out that there were 10 children that needed homes, I'm sure that was overwhelming
yes.
as a concept for them.
Yes.
So only Aunt Grace I had a chance to meet and really have a chance to dialogue with, but in all honesty, if I was to add up how much of the dialogue there was, I would say it probably amounted to 3 hours
mm-hmm.
in my lifetime. So
mm-hmm.
nowhere close to really have a deep appreciation for who my mother was as a person.
Yes. Well, she's certainly in her own way coming through you in many ways, probably. What a great opportunity you have to, like you say, bring those components, those individual
sure.
ingredients, if you would, for creating something marvelous, which is a nice testament to the lineage and the heritage of your family, because as you say, obviously it comes from somewhere. Tell me about what you noticed as you were growing older with your experiences that, you know, gave you the drive to want to say, you know, you could have gone so many places, so many areas, so many ways, and yet it was like right to college. So, you know, tell me what that was about for you.
Sure. I think it was real clear for me when I was about 13 years old. I had sat in front of the administration building of an agency that I was living at called St. Dominic's Home, and the wonderful nun came down the steps, and her name was Sister Mary Patrick, and she was the executive director, and she saw me sitting there, and I wasn't very happy. She said, "Oh, you know, sit there for a minute. I have something to give you." And so she went down to the storeroom and came up with a bicycle and gave me that bicycle,
mm-hmm.
and I really treasured that. But it was also an opportunity for me to realize that for that to happen, it's because she saw something on my face, and she saw something about how I was presenting myself. And I recognized at that point, even though extremely young, that I'm in this world by myself, and I'm going to have to make the most of it. And that reality is Sister Mary Patrick was kind enough to give me a bicycle, but I also have to recognize that it's probably not going to keep happening throughout my life. So I really have to learn to apply myself. And that really, that moment stuck with me. And I'm 43 years old now, and so 30 years later, I can still recall it like it was yesterday.
I imagine.
But just that wake-up call, and there were lots of times when I was there that so many children who had very, very challenging family situations went home for Christmas and Thanksgiving. So often I was the only child that was left in my cottage, and then maybe one of 10 that were maybe left on the campus of maybe 150 children.
Mm-hmm.
So those moments really, brought home that the resources that are there for other children, even though they have very challenging situations, are not there for me. So that was a wake-up call that I really needed to start looking out for myself and making some choices that were going to position me. And so I would say when I was about the same age, I started signing my name, Nathaniel J. Williams, Executive Director, because that's all I knew was social services and leadership. And so by the time I was 27, I could actually sign that, and that was really my legal and earned title.
Great.
So I think that for me, having an opportunity to recognize that circumstance and then to start dreaming about what I wanted for myself, and my feeling was, I don't know anything else. This is what I've lived. Why not turn this around into to doing what I do with the rest of my life, being was a major part of the beginning of my life.
Big and powerful concept for a young man at puberty, adolescence to really grab onto.
Sure. But I also remember a situation around that same time. The agency had turned, I think it reached their 100th year.
Yeah.
And so we had a mass at St. Patrick's Cathedral. And Cardinal Cook was the cardinal at that particular point, and I was an altar boy.
Mm-hmm.
And he turned to me, and he said, it looks like, we have our next bishop sitting here.
Mm.
And again, I was the altar boy and so enamored with the cardinal. But I recognized it in moments like that, that there was something that I was given that others may not have been given to the same degree, and I really needed to maximize that. If this man, who only met me for a very short period of time with the enormous power that he did have, thought...
Oops, I think we just got disconnected, did we not? Well, we're going to take a quick break, and hopefully we'll get Dr. Williams back on the call. So we'll be right back, folks. Hold on, Wellness Roadshow.
The time is right. I'm going to pack my bags and take that journey down the road. Because over the mountain I see.
With Restoring Essence Holistic Health and Nutritional Counseling, you will learn how to nourish and energize your life and experience health, balance, and vitality every day. Do you want to lose weight, detoxify your body, reduce or eliminate sugar cravings and stress, increase energy levels, or simply look and feel younger to rediscover your zest for life? At Restoring Essence Holistic Health and Nutritional Counseling, our mission is to guide you to personally discovering what nourishes and feeds your remarkable life. We want you to experience what it feels like to nurture your body, mind, spirit, and earth so that you can savor your life. During our simple-to-follow customized wellness, nutrition, and lifestyle programs, we will provide you with the awareness and skills to identify what is right for you in all aspects of your life. Go to www.restoringessence.com or call 312-613-5992.
Hello, this is James Arthur Ray, and you are listening to the best network online, Contact Talk Radio.
Hello, welcome back. Sorry for that little glitch that happens sometimes on live radio, but we have Dr. Williams back with us. This is Wellness Roadshow, Catherine Bradford, your host. Welcome back, Dr. Williams.
Thank you so much.
I was asking if you fell in the pool. That would have been nice.
I'm sitting here in the hotel lobby. So.
Okay, good. Hopefully it's not a busy lobby.
No, it's not. I'm so glad.
Anyway, you were talking about this connection that you had with the at your church. Go ahead with that then again.
Well, again, the cardinal was the Archbishop of New York and had held this special mass. And again, people have asked me, what has it been for you? And it really has been moments like that. I wasn't really blessed with any one person that really shepherded me through my young adulthood. It really was different moments that I experienced, and I was able to take, you know, so much from those moments and use that as some guidance to go forth.
Right.
And I think that with people that's so important, is that you take what is given to you and you maximize it. It may not be the optimum. You may hope that you're given one individual who can see you through one period of time to the next, but it just may be that there are just situations that you're placed in that you just have to maximize. I saw a wonderful a PowerPoint presentation that was sent as an email that talked about life on a train, and I thought it was really, you know, talking directly to me, because it talked about, especially parents, how sometimes they're on that train for a short period of time, and then they went on to say something that I think some people would argue with, but they went on to say that they're on that train for as long as they need to be, and then went on to make some other points about life. And for me, that was a really refreshing piece of information to have, as you question why did things happen the way they are. Again, I have to look at where I am today, and if some events were not the same, I may not be here. It could be in a better place or a worse place, but I just have to understand that things happen for a reason, and maybe that was the time that my mom needed to share with me, and I needed to, you know, to crusade on and do what I need to do and take advantage of the circumstances that life gives.
Well, I love the piece here, and I think it's so important, and it certainly is reflected in your book, which we're going to talk about in just a second, but this whole idea of, you know, having children at an early enough age certainly understand their responsibility around their ability to create and be self-responsible.
Sure.
And, you know, offering some of these concepts and, you know, putting the power in their hands and offering them tools that they can say, wow, they can really create and go any way they want, is a great way to help them understand, I think, and move into the world as certainly individual and yet interdependent, if you would, on the social, you know, that they create as well, the social system. But so you have this great book that you've created. I want to thank you for that, The Navigator of Life, Keeping Your Ship of Life on Balance and on Course. And it's really interesting, and I know that, you know, it's really meant to be a tool, it feels like to me. Is that correct? The whole purpose for creating it was really just to offer us sort of a new way to look at things, right?
Sure. And it really was, and again, it's a self-help decision-making tool.
Right.
And it really was to help you look at every kind of decision that you have to make.
Right.
Whether you're the head of a Fortune 100 company, or you're just a person, a kid looking at what school do I want to go to, or whether I want to go to school, or do I want to just go directly into the workforce.
Right.
So it's really saying that this applies for any person, and it's basically asking that you look at eight different dimensions that a situation may present itself. So
right.
You want to look at how this decision may impact your spirituality, but also how does your spirituality speak to the decision that you have to make.
Right.
Education, what do you know about the situation the decision you're going to make, and more importantly, what don't you know?
Yeah.
In other areas, recreation, how much, by making this decision, how much time will I have to enjoy myself and enjoy others? And so there's eight different areas that it's basically asking that every decision we make, we triage that decision through those eight domains. And my belief is, if we don't have clearance in all eight of those domains, we should not make that decision to proceed in that particular area. So an example would be for a person that they're offered a job, let's say they're living in Massachusetts, and they're offered a job in Georgia.
Okay.
And yes, in one of the eight areas, it's financial. So yes, you may get a bump in your salary, but your family and friends, which is one of the other areas, would be impacted negatively.
Right.
Your health and your fitness may be impacted because your doctors and your support network are here, and you've established that very well, and you may have a doctor who is one of a kind. So an example would be, yes, on the financial side, it looks pretty good, but in some of the other areas, it doesn't look as good.
Right.
And so often people come back to recognize, oh, boy, if I would have considered this aspect or that aspect, I would have made a different decision. So it's basically saying all decisions, put them through this filter, these dimensions, and if you find yourself affirmative in all of those areas and you've thought about the ups and downs of it, then it's probably a good decision to make, because it's in balance.
Right.
And you've considered all the different aspects.
Right. I want to jump right back into the roots of some of these things, though, because the very beginning of the book does draw up some pretty interesting points that I think are, for a lot of people, going to be wake-up calls, because maybe people are really very unconscious in a lot of their decision-making and sort of that knee-jerk reaction that so many of us may have. And so much of what influences us is just under the surface, where we're not even giving it any, you know, as I said, you know, the awareness is just really reduced there. Obviously, you talk in the beginning of the book about how our lives consist of choices and that some of them are quite easy to make, others are more difficult. I like also how you point out that, you know, success is really achieving goals that are a result of hard work and dedication. And there's several times you say that through the book, including at the very end as well. You're saying, you know, this isn't a quick fix, easy, you know, read it in 5 minutes and there you go. This really requires some, you know, nose to the grindstone effort on people, right?
Correct.
And so the importance of our own decisions with what it how it moves us forward. One thing that you mentioned, though, which I thought was so interesting, was that you really felt like decisions either were rooted in feelings or emotions of shame or feelings and emotions of empowerment. Can we talk about that a little bit?
Sure.
Because I think that's really important.
Sure. I think that that is so key to just recognizing how we speak to the world and how the world speaks to us.
Yes.
If we just watch television and look at the advertisements that come across the television,
yeah,
it really is talking to us about shame. It's basically saying that if you want to be somebody, if you want to have a certain life, if you want to have a certain experience, then you need to have this product pretty close in hand in order for that to happen.
Right.
One of the things I do is, as part of a training workshop, is I say, you know, let's take newspapers. You know, we'll go out to the store in the lobby, and we'll get them from wherever you want them, whether they're the New York Times or whatever paper you want. And I say, okay, fine, let's look at all of the advertisements, and I want you to find me an advertisement that does not talk from the vantage point of shame. And I've done that maybe 25 times, and I can't tell you one other than one time a person was able to find an advertisement that just listed the movie time, and that was it.
Wow.
Now, if you then read the titles of the movies, you would probably have to throw that ad out as well. But so much of the information that we receive is attempting to make us feel inadequate in order to make us feel adequate.
Yeah.
And also our communications with others. A lot of times we attempt, especially the ones we love, to compare them against somebody else, which again will attempt to shame them into doing what we want them to do. We'll put that in writing. So often the emails we receive, especially at work, are basically talking about using the vantage point of shame in which to communicate with us, you know, that our department will not look good, and that the person before you was able to do this. And so much of the information we receive is talking to us from the vantage point of shame.
Mm-hmm.
And the thinking is to really turn that around and really and to look at things from the vantage point of empowerment. Because there are four behaviors that are going to be, people are generally going to demonstrate when they're working from shame or working from empowerment.
Yes, I love this one.
The four behaviors as they relate to empowerment are totally different kind of behaviors and ones that are more upbuilding than the ones that you're going to have from shame.
Let's talk about those because they're so great. Let's first, since we talked about shame, do the four states that are, you know, categorized.
When you're working from shame, generally what you're going to do, if, let's say, something, if someone's talking to you and comparing you to someone else, you're going to withdraw.
Yeah.
Okay, that's one thing. Or you're going to avoid. You're not going to have contact with that particular person any longer
right.
in that circumstance.
Avoidance.
You may attack yourself.
Yeah.
And may join in the bandwagon, bring yourself down.
Yeah.
Or you may attack others. You may come back and say, you know what, I'm going to stand up and let them know what my feelings are.
Yes.
But those are generally the four different behaviors the four different areas that a person can take that shame and run with it, which, again, I think everyone would agree, are not areas that we would find productive. And some of the emotions that go along with that is a feeling of, you know, feeling of jealousy and guilt and prejudice and anger and disgust and despair. So that, you know, that shameful kind of interaction generally leads us into an area that is not the kind of behaviors that we're looking for and the kind of emotions we want to have.
Right.
Now, the opposite is empowerment. And generally, there are four behaviors that come from that, a sense of engagement, a sense of integration and collaboration. You want to work with others.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, others want to work with you as well. You want to build yourself and your family, and you want to build your community. So when we're working from empowerment, there are just it just gives us a far stronger in which to accomplish the things we want. And then we feel a sense of happiness and a sense of being in control, a sense of value, a sense of being grounded. But so often, so much of the stuff that we're experiencing every day is not from empowerment. It's really from shame. And so I think when what I've heard from people as they read the book and they've had a chance to have interactions with me is that they were never on patrol for that. They were never looking at shame versus empowerment. But now that they've become on patrol and looking for that, they see that so often, and they're able to catch themselves before they go down that street, which they really don't want to do.
Well, that's why I said I love so much the very beginning when you brought this up, because I was like, wow, I hadn't looked at it that way. And it offers you, again, you know, it's just such a wonderful way to, you know, imagine looking out your window in your living room and you're so familiar with the view across the street, and suddenly someone comes up and takes a special rag and wipes the glass and says, look again. And it's such a, it just changes what you're looking at. And it's so nice, as you said, you know, once you move into this concept of understanding yourself and trying to look at what you're doing and your decisions that you make based on these two components here, it's just very, very powerful piece of information. And to me, amazing how much of the world falls into those two categories, you know. Don't you feel, though, Dr. Williams, with all the work you've done over the years, especially over the last several years, do you see that just globally, as a rule, that we are forming collaborative, cooperative groups, changing systems and the way we work as communities that fall more on the line of the chart here that talks about empowerment?
I think that there's an effort, but I think that a natural aspect that also has to be considered is another chapter in the book that talks about the absolutes of life as well.
Yes, let's talk about that.
And I'll tie the two of those together.
Yes.
In answering your question.
Yeah.
That there are three absolutes of life that are noted. Number one is that there's always going to be change and transition.
Yes.
That one of the things I do when I'm going over this in a workshop is I'll show them a picture of myself when I was 18 years old with a tight white pants on and a full head of hair and about 50 pounds lighter.
Mm-hmm.
And then I say, look at me now.
Mm-hmm.
And as a, just a reminder to them that, you know, I'm a little bit bigger, I have no hair, things change. But I didn't know that. And I have to be reminded that that's an absolute of life, is that I'm gonna look different as I get older. So that's,
honey, I think
absolute.
That's a problem we all have.
Sure,
you know?
Sure.
Yeah,
but I
yeah.
think it's important to recognize
right.
when we
oh,
start
yeah.
a job,
mm-hmm.
it's going to sometimes change and transition to something else. When we start a relationship, our role is going to potentially change to something. But I think we're not aware of that, that that's an absolute that will definitely happen. Things will change and they will transition to other phases.
Right.
Secondly is that there's going to be accountability and reckoning.
Mm-hmm.
So often I think we hear about circumstances in the public arena where we find out that people are eventually held accountable and have to reckon for their behaviors,
mm-hmm.
sometimes later than expected, but it does eventually happen. One of the things that I, you know, tell people is I love a Pepsi and a Twinkie,
mm-hmm.
but trust me, there is accountability and reckoning for that being part of my diet plan.
Right.
And so sometimes it's not going to be something you're going to immediately deal with, but it's something you will have to deal with later. So that's
right.
the second absolute life.
Right.
And the third absolute is that everything is going to have an end and will terminate.
Yes.
As wonderful as it has been talking with you, this conversation will come to an end
right.
and will terminate. And that
right.
everything we start, once we start it, is eventually working toward its end and its termination.
Right.
So those absolutes, along with recognizing the shame and the empowerment, are important to keep in mind when we look at circumstances, because I think so often efforts are begun to try to address issues, but we don't recognize that things will change and they will transition. So often that a group may come together to solve a problem, but they have to begin to think about, what if this problem isn't here any longer? And what will we then do with our energy after that happens? So let's say we're working on this parking problem. But let's say eventually this problem is solved. What do we do with that energy? And so what I encourage people to do is always begin with the end in sight. And if the end is that this problem may go away or this circumstance go away, let's work with that in a very progressive and positive kind of way. So in answer to your question, I think a lot of efforts are being made to work with things from a more empowerment-based approach. But I think sometimes the absolutes of life that people don't work toward the end. I was doing a retreat for an organization, and their concentration is on drugs and alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, you know, what happens if there is a miracle drug that comes out that addresses the addiction issue for a majority of people. What happens to the organization in that particular circumstance?
Mm-hmm.
In reality, they recognize, oh, my Lord, we just assumed that the societal state would continue with this always being a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And so they began thinking about, you know, what we're really working with people on is life skills. We're really trying to empower them. We're really so that they were able to begin to widen their mission as well as their vision to say, you know what, these kinds of issues will live on forever, where possibly some of these other issues may be mitigated with the advances of science. So, again, it's important that in everything we do that we recognize that we're working toward the end and truly not assume that the work that we do will go on forever. I think if we're doing a really, really good job, most likely the things that we touch should eventually go away because we've done the job that is needed to be done to address the issue.
What's been your experience in working with so many different diverse groups, but all in, as I said, with some sort of, you know, social point, if you would, and all mm-hmm. these different various issues? What is your experience around where is the most, what would be the great way of asking this question? Where do you attack for the greatest opportunity for success? You know, where do you put the energy into? At what point? You're
sure.
talking about individual here as opposed
sure.
to a lot of group stuff. So,
sure. And I also think it's the same thing for a group as it is for individual.
Yeah.
I think we need to go where the success is.
Yeah.
And I think so often we begin where the problem is. And I think reality is in some part of the country, some part of the world, this problem has probably been addressed and solved. And so often we are barriered in by the geography. So if we're in a township, that's as far as we go. If we're in a region of the state, that's as far as we go. We're in a state, that's as far as we go. And I always encourage people to go where the answer is. And if the answer is in Canada, if the answer is in Mexico, if the answer is in Europe, then seek that answer. But don't let those boundaries that have been man-made be the thing that keeps you from going where success is. So
mm-hmm.
so often I think we believe that the problem can't be solved. I was working with a charter school in Philadelphia. And they, their first year, and they had some real struggles. But I had been to a conference, and there's a gentleman named Ron Clark, who was, I think, a Walt Disney Teacher of the Year in 2000. This gentleman is phenomenal, and he runs a charter school in Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said, you know what, I'll waive my fee for doing these two workshops with you if you promise to then use it to take two of your teachers to fly down to Atlanta to see the school. And we had tried to make a visit to the school, but in the meantime, he was having a conference at a local hotel in Atlanta, which included a visit to the school. So they went down there, and they were jazzed beyond belief. And this school is wonderful. The way you get from the second floor to the first floor is you take a slide from the second floor to the first floor. He talked about an 81-year-old lady who was visiting the school to donate some money, and he showed her the steps, and she said, no, back it up here. I'm going down this slide. And so he said his prayers, and she went down, and she was able to still write the check on the other end, and he was a happy camper.
Good.
But that was a good example of some charter schools are really struggling, but there are some out there that are really having a wonderful time. And his building is in a crack-infested, prostitute-ridden area in Atlanta, but he was able to get a very good deal, and the kids are going to school in uniforms and having a good time, and the teachers write on the blackboard with their finger. So you don't have to worry about dirty chalk because he has the best technology in that school that is out there.
Mm-hmm.
But again, that's the difference between a successful charter school, but it's not around the corner to Philadelphia, it's in Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, given a little bit of money, they were able to get down there, and the two teachers wrote back that it was just phenomenal for them, and they are jazzed for the next school year beyond belief.
Yeah. Tell me, what is the basic age group that you find, you're all over the map, you work with children as well as adults all over
sure.
the place?
Sure. Uh-huh. Sure, and the services that the organization that I lead provides is serving
right.
the children who are dependent in group homes, and also we have adults with mental retardation and autism as well.
Right.
And what is interesting, and this is just an event that happened about 3 weeks ago, I've been working with individuals with mental retardation and autism for years, since I was 18 years old. But about 3 weeks ago, I told you earlier, we have six kids and we have a set of twins. The boy twin has had some developmental delays, and so we had him evaluated, and he was diagnosed with autism. And so people were, you know, saying to him, oh, my Lord, I feel so sorry for you, and it's such a challenge. But, you know, I think that our higher power puts us in a position to be prepared for whatever lies ahead. And you know, these last 20-something years of working with individuals, maybe it was just to prepare me for this particular moment in my life,
yes,
where I have this 2-year-old young guy, Taj, who's my son, that I have to figure out, you know, where do we go with this next part of our journey?
Yes.
So just being open to recognize that things happen for a reason. Sometimes you will not understand what they are. But if you take the opportunity to look for the good in them, a lot can come out of that. So I can only imagine what this will mean for my family and for Taj in the future, but I can only imagine very good and positive things. If you could see Taj, he is the most loving, a handsome little guy,
mm-hmm,
and has this particular challenge. But so often we look at our situation and we feel sorry for ourselves. And as I said to you last month, we went on vacation. We were down at the Jersey Shore, and there were some individuals there, some children, with some very, very, very severe issues, and their parents were still out and enjoying themselves. And it was a reminder to me, because it's only about a week or so old, that we had shared, we had gotten the information, I have nothing to feel sorry for and to complain about. But again, it's taking these circumstances and applying them to myself so that I can help apply it to others. But I'm not any different than any person with the kinds of issues that we have to deal with. And I think some would say the kinds of issues I've had to deal with are maybe 2 or 3 people's issues all in one. But again, I've tried to look for what the blessing is rather than the burden.
Well, I think that's very apparent in what you begin the book with, which is what you call the pledge. And I think what it does is it gives you sort of like a song to start singing, a little motto to begin, you know, to begin any process that you talk about in the book with.
Sure.
Why don't we talk and tell the listeners what the pledge actually is?
You know, the funny thing is that when I think about, if people don't take anything from this book, if they could just take the pledge from it, they'll be fine. And,
mm-hmm,
and working with, especially with the children,
mm-hmm,
we find that the pledge is where they go wrong. And the pledge is basically, as you said, Catherine, is a way to wake up in the morning and just remind yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And the
mm-hmm
four things you're going to remind yourself is, the first is to be grateful.
Mm-hmm.
And to say, you know what, today is here, make the most of it.
Mm-hmm.
Tomorrow is gone. I mean, yesterday is gone. Tomorrow is in the future. But today is right now and something that I can control.
Mm-hmm.
Second thing is to be aware, and it's to learn as much as you can about the much you don't know. And so people, you know, say to me, what is that about? Well, you know, that may explain these academic pursuits that that there's so much out there that I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I recognize that I'm so very blessed, especially as I've pursued this master's in business administration.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how the organizations I've led have been profitable and sustained themselves with the lack of information I did have. So so being aware and learning as much as you can about the much you don't know is so important.
Right.
Thirdly, to be appreciative.
Right.
And this is, I think, very important, that everybody, every place, that everything has value. And it is not your job to be judge, jury, and executioner and determine who's of value, who should be and who should not be. But everything has value. You may not understand what that value is,
mm-hmm,
but every person, place, and thing does. And then lastly is to be happy. And it goes along with being appreciative, is to find the beauty in the people, places, and things you experience every day, and
mm-hmm
find a way to celebrate that. And so often people want to, you know, make it for, you know, I want to celebrate my birthday, I want to celebrate this. But we are here today, and I think we need to find a way to celebrate all those things that happened. You know, that we arrived someplace safely, that we had at lunch with someone, that we did, that those are all things that we need to celebrate. And I think stop waiting for these big moments,
mm-hmm,
because I find in life it's the little moments that are far more teaching and learning opportunities than the larger moment.
Absolutely. You know, in the book, another very strong point that you talked about was core beliefs, and I think that's such an important piece because, as I said at the very beginning, when we were looking at decisions and these steps that you talk about, you know, that you said, make sure that you look at education, spirituality, personal development, health, all these things, family and friends, and evaluate these as components of making your decision. And I thought, you know, a lot of people may not be aware of a lot of these little pieces. Talk to me about the core belief piece that comes into so much of our decision making.
Sure. It's basically just remembering as a person, like, what do I stand for? You know, what is my mission? And these 8, which is basically to say, everything I do, I want to have a positive impact. And I'm on the telephone today with, you know, Catherine and her audience, and I want to have a positive impact. And I'm in a restaurant and I'm ordering food. I want to make that, you know, experience for that person who's the waitress or the waiter positive as well. So no matter what I'm doing, I want to leave it with a positive impact. Next is for me to constantly and continuously improve myself, that I, I'm not a job done at any particular point. And I have a wonderful uncle who says, when you know, he'll say, good to see you. And he's a little bit over 80, and he says, you know what, it's good to be seen. And that's just a reminder to us that every day is precious, and he's remembering that at his age that it's good to be on this side of the ground. And
yeah.
So we should always continue to improve ourselves, because we sometimes think that time we don't have a lot of, and we're given another day. I think we should look at a way to improve ourselves. Next is for there to be respect for a higher power. I don't care honestly what that higher power is. I just think it's important to recognize that we are not the only person that we're accountable, that there is someone in a higher position, something in a higher position that we should have as a core belief of who we are as a person. Next is for us to put forth our best appearance. You know, some of us are not gifted with money and resources and other, but we should put forth the best appearance that we can so that we're given ourselves the best opportunity we can afford.
Mm-hmm.
The next is for there to be respect. Not always that respect will be given, but will be received, but it will always be given.
Mm-hmm.
And so often I've seen, you know, when I've held the door for someone and I call them sir, and they may be in a position that is not accustomed to receiving that, it goes such a long, long, long way.
Mm-hmm.
Next is that there always are going to be standards and rules. And I think so often we don't recognize that those things exist. There are procedures and protocols, and we need to recognize that there's, you're buying a car, you're getting married, you're going on a date, whatever it is, there are standards and rules, and we should try to find out what those are. And last, and I think very most important, is that we demonstrate language and behavior that is upbuilding. So often we participate in stuff that, gossiping and bringing down others.
Mm-hmm.
And my feeling is, if it's not upbuilding, if it's not going to make the world a better place, and it's not something that I want to waste my time to be part of.
Well, it sounds to me like this is sort of what I'm hearing and coming up with as you're talking is like, well, if you begin applying these practices, these fundamental practices to just the way you are, then it will naturally unfold in and be a part of whatever decision you make, right?
For sure.
And as a result, you'll move into any decision-making process, whether it be a small one or a large, difficult one,
sure,
with the confidence of a sense of self-awareness and self-knowledge that only can empower you to make a much more, successful decision for
right.
you, for your goal.
Yep. And I think, Catherine, decisions are so underrated, but it's something that is under-talked about. It's something we do every day. That's one thing no matter who we are, what walk of life we are, we're making decisions all the time.
Right.
But I think so little guidance has been given to so many people about how to do that. And so what this is basically saying is, just making a decision based on, your health aspect or your family and friends is one thing, but also to look at, there are some absolutes that you have to deal with. There are some core beliefs, but it's a package deal.
Mm-hmm.
And what the book is attempting to do is to try to offer that package information so that you really have no place to run. If this is something you want to make better decisions, I'm really hoping that the book provides a tremendous platform where there isn't any wiggle room, that if this is something you want to do, that all that information, even though it's a very concise book,
yes,
and only 50-something pages long, but
right.
it really gives you, I think, the ammunition to make decisions which are going to set you up for success.
It certainly offered me a lot of new ways to think about things, which I really appreciate very
much.
Listen, we're plumb out of time, and I would love to offer, I can't believe it, I'd love to offer to our guests, listeners here, the, what was that? Did he go away again? Are you there, doctor?
Nope,
he left, didn't he? Well, listen, while he hopefully gets back on the line, I'm just going to go ahead and information. That was Dr. Williams with me today. Nathaniel Williams, who's written the book, The Navigator of Life, Keeping Your Ship on Life in Balance and on Course. And to find out more about this book, you can contact, there's a website, which is Navigate Your Life or Navigate of Life. I'm sorry, Navigator of Life, www.navigatoroflife.com. Again, you can also go to the website of Dr. Williams, which is www.nj-williams.com. That was very great having him as a guest today. I'm sorry he's not here to say goodbye to you himself. At the end of the show here, I'll see if we can't get him back on, but probably not, as we're sort of out of time, are we not, Gary? Very good. Well, listen, thank you very much for joining us. The next hour will be up again with Karen Casey. And then tonight, a very special show on Dot to Dot. I hope you join us for that. And we'll look forward to talking to you again soon. Bye-bye for now.
time is right, I'm gonna pack my bags and take that journey down the road. 'Cause over the mountain, I see the bright sunshine.